If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series power tool accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
It's still going approximately 23 miles an hour when that ends.
God damn it. You'll have to zoom in on that so the jury can see what you're referring to. Please.
So again, as I mentioned, the text stream's taking a window of data. It doesn't take anything outside the window. You can see that when we account for the wheel slippage, that the vehicle at the time of the last data point, again, is at 74% throttle, 3,300 revolutions per minute, and is going backwards approximately 23.9 miles per hour. And you can see it's traveled a total distance backwards of 53 feet back from where it initially started, or if you consider where it pulled forward 34 feet and then backed up 53 feet, add those two together from the point it pulled all the way forward. So this is 10, 20, 30, 5, forward. And then I'll go 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 3, back. For a total of 87 feet. So from the maximum point I pulled forward to where it backed up, again, that was 34 feet forward, then a total of 53 back, total travel distance of 87 feet. So went all the way forward where it stopped, it then backed up 87 feet. And when the text stream data stopped, it's still moving. It's still moving about 23 miles an hour, and you're still at 74% throttle and 3,300 revolutions per minute on the tachometer, RPM gauge.
We could turn the light on for a moment. Dr. Welcher, in your analysis of the data and the information you acquired and the evidence that you relied upon, did you come to some conclusions and opinions regarding the defendant's Lexus that evening?
I did.
As part of that opinion, you mentioned that you considered mileage to map distances as one way of mapping the location of the vehicle. Do you remember that?
I do.
If you could provide us with slide... I believe it's slide 25. And could you widen the left-handed box a little bit? And you mentioned you measured or you ran information about distances between different routes?
Correct.
Specifically regarding Fairview to Meadows, the first box. Do you see that?
I do.
There are three different mileage numbers.
Yes.
And then there's streets to the left. Can you explain what's set out in that box?
Sure. It's basically three different routes you can go. Sherman Street, Pleasant Street, Washington, and Sherman Street.
When you considered the shortest route, 2.3 miles on Sherman Street, did you attempt to determine how long it would take to travel 2.3 miles, how fast the car would have to be moving or how slowly it would have to be moving to travel 2.3 miles in 4 minutes and 15 seconds?
Yes.
And what did you determine?
So to go 2.3 miles in 4 minutes and 15 seconds, you would need an average speed of 32.47 miles an hour.
What if you took the longest route, 2.8 miles, and you considered 2.8 miles in 4 minutes and 15 seconds? Did you make a determination?
I did.
Could you share that with the jury?
It's 39.5 miles per hour.
Is that what the average speed of the Lexus would need to be to travel that distance in that
Correct.
Time?
Okay.
Now, turning to your study of these Techstream events, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty how many triggering events occurred? How many triggering events occurred in that ignition cycle 1162?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to allow that.
In 1162, the Techstream recorded two triggering events.
And do you have an opinion as to the type of triggering event, the type of movement of the defendant's Lexus in those two triggering events?
I do.
Regarding the first triggering event, 1162-1, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty what type of event the first triggering event was?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to allow that.
The actual trigger was excessive rearward acceleration. The event was during the course of a three-point turn.
And do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty the time between triggering event one and triggering event two in that cycle 1162?
Yes.
And could you share with the jury your opinion to a reasonable degree of science, of engineering certainty the time between those two triggering events?
Approximately 8 minutes and 5 seconds.
And do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty as to the type and triggering event of the second event, 1162-2?
I do.
And could you share with the jury your opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty the type of event to that second triggering event?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to allow it.
It's, again, the trigger event itself was a transition into reverse and then high throttle application. It's a forward motion followed by a lengthy high speed rear impact or rear motion.
Your Honor, I'm going to move to strike that portion of the answer.
Yes, I'm not going to highlight it. Get the answer again.
Do you like me to ask the question again, Your Honor?
Yes, Mr. Lessie, yes, right? I'll strike the previous answer. Go ahead and ask the question again.
Okay. Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty as to the nature of the second triggering event 1162-2?
Just for the record,
Yep.
Yes.
Could you share your opinion with the jury?
The triggering event was high throttle opening in a transition to reverse, It's a forward motion followed by a higher speed rear motion. And at the end of the trigger event, you're still at 74% throttle.
Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty the entire distance captured in that 10-second window during the back maneuver or 1162-2?
Do I have an opinion about it?
Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty about
yes.
the entire distance that is captured in that 10-second window of the second triggering event, 1162-2?
So it obviously only captures what's going on during the trigger. It doesn't capture before or after the trigger.
Understood. Do you have an opinion as to just what is captured as far as the distance?
Yes.
And what is your opinion?
That it's 87 feet. Okay. So again, the initial forward motion is 34 feet, followed by it backing, crossing the initial point, and then backing up an additional 53 feet.
And finally, regarding this part of your analysis, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty as to whether the defendant's Lexus was decelerating, accelerating, or remaining the same at the end of that data captured at the triggering event 1162-2?
It was accelerating at 74% throttle.
In addition to your analysis of the text stream data, one final question. Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty the relative time this backing maneuver occurred with the defendant's Lexus that you just spoke about?
Yes.
And could you share with the jury your opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty?
Sure. It matches the window of the cell phone data for Mr. O'Keefe that puts it in front of 34 Fairview. So the backing event occurred somewhere between 12:32:04 and 12:32:12.
Sir, I now want to turn to a different part of your study of this case.
Okay.
At some point, did you try to determine whether there was an intervening event that could have caused damage to the defendant's right rear taillight separate from a collision at Fairview?
I did.
Objection, Your Honor.
So the form of the question is to Brennan.
Okay. At some point when you looked at the data and analyzed this case, did you consider including or excluding evidence, or did you analyze evidence to reach a conclusion, including or excluding whether there was an intervening event that caused damage to the defendant's Lexus right rear taillight?
Yes, I did.
When you started your analysis, what information or claim or evidence did you become aware of that you want to analyze to include or exclude as the cause of that damage?
Sure. So my approach to this case is three prongs. I'm looking at the downloads, the technical information. I'm looking at this backing incident, and then I'm looking at Mr. O'Keefe's injuries and how they relate to the events, potentially. So the second prong, which is looking at this data. So I had a Ring doorbell video showing Ms. Reed backing the Lexus out of Mr. O'Keefe's residence at approximately 5 o'clock in the morning. And so we wanted to look at the backing activity and whether that backing, contacting Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle, whether that was sufficient to cause or what damage it could cause, and particularly was it sufficient to cause damage to the right rear taillight of the Lexus.
When you were asked to engage in the study, were you ever asked to reach a certain conclusion?
Never.
Was there ever any influence other than the data and facts on your analysis?
There's never been any influence. The influence, again, it's whatever the data shows.
When you engaged in whatever studies you undertook that you'll explain to the jury, were you given any direction or limitations on what you could or should do?
No.
When you received the information, did you understand, regardless of the result, it would be provided to everybody?
I guess, generally, yes. I mean, I go through the data, I give you the results, you do with them whatever you see fit.
Okay. And in this case, when you decided to engage in that study, had you had an opportunity to review the Ring video footage from Mr. O'Keefe's home on the morning of January 29, 2022?
Yes.
Tell us how you went through your study, how you began, and the steps you took, please.
Sure. Probably be best on the slides. So one of the things we first did was to get an exemplar Lexus. What does exemplar mean? It just means I got the same exact year, make, and model vehicle as Ms. Reed. So Ms. Reed's vehicle is on the left-hand side, taken during my inspection. And then I found this exact same year, make, model, manufactured at the same plant, everything Lexus in Texas. So even though it looks like a European plate, it's a Texas plate. Purchased the vehicle, had it shipped out to California. So I verified that the Lexus is in fact the one I got, the same exact one as Ms. Reed's. These are all the standard equipment. Ms. Reed's is on the left. My exemplar is on the right. It says Reed Lexus TIS, that's Toyota Information Services, or Toyota Information System. So I ran it through TIS, which is the umbrella program under which Techstream runs. I also ran it through My Lexus, which is the Lexus website. And then started about doing what's referred to as a photogrammetric analysis of the video.
Can you explain to us what a photogrammetric, help me with the word, photogrammetry?
Photogrammatic. Doing photogrammetry is a photogrammetric analysis.
What does that mean?
It's just a big fancy word to saying you're looking at data and photographs, and what we're trying to do is take two-dimensional images that you get from video or photographs, and knowing some information about the photographs and some of the dimensions of things in the image, get or convert it to a three-dimensional space. In other words, be able to get exact three-dimensional measurements out of that two-dimensional image. So I had the video, just to show the provided video that I was given. So Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle, I don't know if you noticed, but there actually is contact between the vehicles. So one of the first things we wanted to do is determine the frame rate, which is how many video frames are played per second. Your normal kind of video camera has about 30 frames per second. Your standard movie is 25 frames a second. You know, a modern IMAX is like 60 frames a second. The frame rate of the camera, how many images it shows per second, because video and films are just single images played really fast, so it looks like motion. And so determining the time between each frame tells you how much time occurred. So if we know the time between each frame, and then we can figure out how far the vehicle moved, distance divided by time is speed. So we put it through a couple different programs. This is called AMP5. We got 19 frames a second. This is a specific forensic program called Axon Investigate, 19.8 frames a second. This is a publicly available program called FFMS. Same thing, 19.8 frames a second. Another program, Media Info, 19.8 frames a second. Anyways, five different sources, we're getting 19.8 frames a second. So then what we've done is add information now. So now that we know how many seconds each frame represents, we now put a clock back in to tie that into time. So it's the same exact video, except we have a frame counter now, and we have a time. So we have some information now on the time between each frame. So here's frame zero. This is frame 265, we're 13 seconds into it. Here's frame 305. Notice you see brake lights on the back wall here. Notice how they're not super red because you still have reverse lights on. Now they all go off. So the Lexus brake lights have been turned off at frame 353. 356. Actually, brake lights begin to come on. 357, they're back on. Lexus comes to a complete stop at frame 369. 384, the reverse lights turn off. So now look how red this is because we no longer have the white reverse lights in it. And you can see the Lexus starts to drive forward. So frame 825, this is after the Lexus has left the scene, but notice the tracks in the snow. So we have very definitive locations for the wheels of the Lexus. We lay over a grid on the various frames. So we then took the images and did what's called clarification, which is where you overlay images from multiple versions or multiple views of the same vehicle, and it helps sharpen the image, but it slightly dulls the color. So you get a little cleaner, crisper image. So here's Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle before clarification, after clarification.
Excuse me, Your Honor, pardon my interruption. Can we get numbers of the slides as we're toggling back and forth?
Sure.
Absolutely. Okay, I'll make an effort. So slide 76. You're welcome. Going to slide 77. We're going to focus in on this area here. So what we will actually show is where the snow was displaced in these two spots, the spots right across from here and right across from here. If you could focus your attention on those. Slide 77. So slide 78. To bring us all together, we went out to Mr. O'Keefe's residence and took a scan, a laser scan. So you see the laser scanner over here. Laser scanner is right here. Fence hasn't changed position. The camera's changed a slight position. We can account for that. So here's the subject video. We have the correct resolution. There's a new camera, it's going slightly faster frame rate. That just means we have different times between frames on the new camera, but we're simply using it for calibration to the old camera. It's the same container for the MP4, and it's using the same video codec. A video codec is how the computer encodes the video.
Slide number.
Oh, yes, thank you, Your Honor. Slide 79. Slide 79, part two. So really, we care most about is the resolution. So slide 80, you can see these are what are called control points. So from the laser scan, we locate these various points. So the 3D scanner knows the exact position of all of these points on slide 80 in the image. And so what we can do is use this information in conjunction with the video to create a scaled version of the video. So when we have three-dimensional images or three-dimensional measurements, we can then use that to give us some three-dimensional information from our 2D video. So there's the points on slide 81. Slide 81, second part, we're basically just fading in. So what you see now, if I go back to the beginning of slide 81, this is the picture from the video camera. And then what you see here is, which is barely any difference, and that's because what we've done is we've now overlaid the points from the laser scan. So now each one of these little speckly points we know the exact 3D coordinates of those. So we can now know the exact position of all these fence posts, all the positions on the driveway, and we can use that to calibrate, going to slide 82. So using that information, it's called solving for the camera. We verify that we have appropriate residuals, meaning we don't have too much error. Slide 83. Okay, subject video. Then this is the subject video with the control points overlaid on it. That's a subject video where we're phasing in the laser scans of the scene, 84. So this is both on slide 84. I'm just toggling between the point cloud and the video. And what I'm trying to illustrate is how well we were able to overlay the point cloud onto the video data. So for example, if you say watch one of these fence post points up here while I toggle between the video . There's a laser scan, there's the video. So we've done a good job. Again, the residuals show that we've done an adequate job of matching the data. Slide 85. So what I'm doing here is toggling between, this is the video of the car. And remember I told you I went out and I inspected Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle and did a laser scan of it? So we're now taking that laser scan of the video, or excuse me, of the vehicle, and overlaying it onto the car in the video. So this is the video image. That's the laser scan laid on top of it. So we know all the dimensions in the laser scan. We know all the dimensions in the scene of this. We have the tire tracks. We can create and take data points along the tire tracks, create a map of those. So green is the right rear. Again, the vehicle's backing out, coming, slide 87, coming out this direction, backing here, stopping, pulling. Pulling forward towards the bottom of the screen. Backing out here, pulling forward like here. Slide 88. So this is the Lexus lined up. This is when the Lexus has come to a complete stop. So this would be maximum engagement. Again, this is just toggling frame 88, showing that we have the time and the frame number. 369 on the same slide. We've now overlaid the Lexus laser scans on top of the image of the Lexus. So there's the video image, a still image that we took from the video. And here's where we overlay the laser scan of the Lexus. So we've overlaid the laser scan of the Lexus onto the Lexus. We've overlaid the laser scan of the Chevrolet onto the Chevrolet. And we've overlaid the laser scan of the scene onto the scene. So now what that allows us to do, we now know the position of everything in there. And we've also tracked the position of the tire tracks. So that's what it looks like if you overlay the computer model of Ms. Reed's vehicle onto the tire tracks.
Slide number, please.
Oh, my apologies, Your Honor.
Okay.
Slide 89, and then I'm just toggling slide 89 where I turn the vehicle off so you can see how the tire positions match up. Another toggle of slide 89. The tire positions line up with where the end of the snow was. From all that information, again, we lined it up in the video, we lined it up in the scene, we have the two vehicles. We can get the exact position of the vehicles when that Lexus stopped. So when that Lexus stopped, that's going to be the maximum engagement. So from that information, we can get the angle of the vehicle, we can get the degree of overlap, the impact configuration, and it's hard to see because of the angles and because these vehicles are not at right angles to each other, the exact contact. Now I mentioned, and we're on slide 94 now, that contact on the rear of the Chevy Traverse. So you can see we actually, and if you can't see, so we took a whole bunch of data points within those two areas where the snow got dislodged, and we're looking at where that is. So if you look at that on the vehicle, so this is where it is on the rear of Mr. O'Keefe's Chevrolet. You see it's about 25 and a half inches above ground, 32 and a half inches above ground. Here's Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. So these marks are kind of, this is the Chevy Traverse words, are approximately right here. Again, I had the opportunity to inspect Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle. There's no damage where these marks are. So sure, it knocked the snow off, but it wasn't sufficient to cause damage to his vehicle. We then mapped that data onto Ms. Reed's vehicle to look at where that height is. So you can see the only contact marks are down at the bumper level. I mentioned how that bumper sticks out. This is exactly where you'd expect it. So the only evidence of contact is nowhere near the upper taillight. Now, I emphasize the word upper taillight because it is right in line with the lower taillight. But yet the lower taillight also was not broken. So again, 25 and a half, that's 24 right here, 25 and a half. That's 24 right here, 25, 25 and a half. That's right where that scuff mark was. It's also right at, again, the level at the top of that light. This light is not broken. I've looked at the front of it, I've looked at the back of it, I've looked all around it, it's not broken, and it sticks out further than the light above it. So using those positions, matching the overlay of the vehicles, we can get the speeds from that. We know where the Lexus is. We know how much time it is between each frame. So we know how far it moved. And so what we know is that when it first came to a stop, right before that, it was going about 0.7 miles per hour. So realistically, somewhere between a half to 1 mile an hour, just to account for some variations, but definitely going 1 mile an hour or less at impact.
Slide number, please.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Slide 99. That's the dimensions. Slide 102. Similar to what I said, no damage to that light, no damage to Mr. O'Keefe's Traverse in that area. And then if I could, I would like to go back because I realized I skipped over something. So this is slide 85. So this is Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle before contact. I don't know what happened this time. The slide shows that we had, there was snow here, and now there's no snow there.
Dr. Welcher, did you look on the driveway after the touching between the two cars to see if you could see anything on the snow at the back of Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle?
So referring to this slide, this is after the Lexus has pulled away. Looking in the snow, I see nothing in the snow.
Were you looking for anything in particular?
Of course I was. I was looking for taillight fragments.
In any of the videos that you have that show Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle after the defendant's Lexus touches it, do you ever see any remnants or shards or fragments of taillight on the ground?
I do not.
When you did your analysis and study trying to include or exclude this touching as the source of damage to the defendant's Lexus rear right taillight, did you consider speed as part of that analysis?
I did. Consider speed, and then again, knowing we have the positions of the vehicle, we looked at the degree of overlap, and there's only about 2 to 3 millimeters of overlap between the vehicles, which is insufficient to cause the taillight that's recessed in from the edge on the right rear of the Lexus to contact the rear of the Chevrolet.
Considering all the data analysis that you did you come to a conclusion, to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty, whether the right rear taillight of Ms. Reed's Lexus was broken or damaged during the contact with Mr. O'Keefe's car at around 5:07 a.m. on January 29, 2022?
That impact did not break or crack that taillight.
Is that your opinion?
That's my opinion.
Is that to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty?
That's to a high degree of engineering certainty.
You mentioned there were three areas of study, and we've been through two.
Correct.
Could you tell us what you focused on your third area of study regarding this case?
So the third area of study, I'm now focusing in on the injuries, the at-scene physical evidence, taillight fragments, broken glass, things of that nature.
Okay. And when you conducted your studies and reached conclusions, did you, in your PowerPoint, provide slides to help explain your process and inevitably your conclusions?
Yes, sir.
Okay. If you can take us through the third section of your efforts regarding this case, specifically your efforts to identify the different pieces of evidence and your conclusions about a collision in this case.
Absolutely. Slide 104.
Please.
Is
this 105, Dr. Welcher?
I'm sorry, 105, yes, sorry. Slide 105, this is a picture of Mr. O'Keefe's right arm, forearm, hand, and wrist. In anatomy, your arm is defined from your shoulder to your elbow, and then from your elbow to your wrist is your forearm, and then this is your hand. So technically, when you say arm, it really means from your elbow to your shoulder. Most people call this whole thing arm. It's actually the upper extremity. Arm is from shoulder to elbow. Elbow to wrist is forearm and hand. So you can see I wrote arm and forearm. So arm, elbow to shoulder, elbow to wrist is forearm. So looking at the injuries to Mr. O'Keefe's arm, forearm, as well as his hand. So this is me. I'm actually 6 feet, half an inch tall. What you see in the upper right is the coroner's examination report for Mr. O'Keefe. He's 73 inches tall. That's 6 feet, 1 inch tall. At this time, I was 220 pounds. Mr. O'Keefe, at the time of this incident, was 216 pounds. So I took measurements of myself. I'm actually wearing the same make and size shoes as Mr. O'Keefe, the same brand of jeans as Mr. O'Keefe, the same brand and size shirt of Mr. O'Keefe. You see the Lexus in the background. We have matched the height to the Lexus. What I'm showing here is both my height, and then keep in mind where the height of this wing is relative to my right eye. So now I'm wearing, in addition, the same shirt and shoes, same type of sweatshirt, and actually the same kind of baseball hat. We tried to determine the exact glass from the waterfall grill. Found out they were getting different ones at different times, but I ordered my glass from the same distributor that Waterfall Grill ordered their glasses from. So you can see in my right hand here, I have a glass. Here's a glass. It looks similar. It's from the same location. And then in the lower right photograph, what I've done is I've rolled up my sleeve, taken the sweatshirt off, and I'm going to look at how this contact pattern lines up. So the first set of slides, I'm simply standing next to the Lexus. We know we have a broken taillight. We know how scratches on Mr. O'Keefe's arm. I'm seeing how those may or may not relate to the height and position of the taillight.
Dr. Welch, if you could back up one slide, I have a question for you. In the middle photograph, at the top of the Lexus, there's like a rim. What do you call that?
I call it a wind wing. I mean, it could be a wing.
Okay, thank you.
Air dam would be another. Okay, so I then set about to do a little bit of testing with the Lexus. The first test you're gonna see is me just walking backwards, or actually sideways, into the Lexus. What I've done is I've painted the Lexus right rear taillight with what's called grease paint. Kind of sort of like paint, but it doesn't dry. And then I have backed up sideways, side shuffled into the Lexus with my arm out, see what the damage pattern looks like, or basically where someone of Mr. O'Keefe's height's arm would contact the rear taillight. So then what you see is I've shown the photographs again. I show the paint transfer onto my arm. The yellow grease paint on my hand was to show where my hand would hit the taillight. And so just kind of me walking slowly sideways into it, the approximate location of the taillight, and I'll line it up with the broken taillight in a second, lines up with the approximate location of the lacerations on Mr. O'Keefe's arm.
Dr. Welch, let me ask you a question. When you're engaging these demonstrations, are you attempting to try to show exactly how Mr. O'Keefe was struck?
No, so we don't know exactly how he was struck, and pedestrian impacts are extremely sensitive to exact angles, and so where exactly your foot is, whether your foot's off the ground, can have an effect on where you end up after that. We just don't have enough information in this case to determine all that information. We know the taillight was broken. We know the glass was broken. So it's not, we know we have damage to the rear of the Lexus. We know we have lacerations in Mr. O'Keefe's arm. So I'm trying to see if there's any correlation between all those.
Well, can body posture on a clip or a side swipe collision change the trajectory or the injury?
Of course.
Can the way somebody moves or reacts before impact change it?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
What are other things that can change the trajectory of the person and the injuries?
So, for example, if you get hit and knocked off balance, or clipped and knocked off balance, you can take additional steps. That'll affect how far your body travels. If you have one foot on the ground versus the other foot on the ground, affects how the body rotates. If your arm is at 90 degrees or 85 degrees, will affect the kinematics. We attempted to model different possibilities, and we're getting results that were all over the map. Small changes in the pedestrian position give you huge change in the output. And so from the text stream data, we don't know exactly when in the text stream data he was hit. So we don't even know the exact impact speed. In most pedestrian reconstructions, you typically have a point where the impact occurred, like where the person was, like in the crosswalk, for example, and they get hit and their tire leaves a rubber scruff. That's called the area of impact or point of impact. You then can look at how far they were thrown and using some laws of physics, calculate how fast the car had to be going. Well, we don't have that in this case. We don't know exactly where Mr. O'Keefe was on the roadway when this happened. Sorry, I'm about to go to the next slide.
Without having an exact point of impact or an exact speed or an exact body position, are you able to specifically replicate the actual collision and the way Mr. O'Keefe's body would move?
Exactly replicate? No. And again, in terms of how he would move, again, we don't know where exactly on the roadway he started. So in terms of how he moved, that's a function of where he started. We don't know if when he was clipped, he took an additional step before falling backwards. So that will change how far you are off the roadway. So the impact, which you'll see in a second, even at 2 miles an hour, will induce rotation of the body. So depending on the speed, the higher the speed, the more rotation. So if I may, so slide 111, this is simply showing where I walk sideways, how this lines up with the location of the lacerations on Mr. O'Keefe's arm. Here's the post-contact scuffing on the taillight. Here's a picture of Ms. Reed's vehicle on the right-hand side. So now I said, okay, you know, that was me walking into the car. Let's have the car drive into me. I did this at very low speeds. And you'll see, and we'll throw this from two different angles. That's me showing I'm doing test two. This is from a camera that we have pointing down at it. This is the speed. You'll see it's only about a 2 mile an hour impact. But even a 2 mile an hour impact redirects me back and causes me to rotate and take a step.
Yes. And what slide is this? I think I just can't see it. What slide is this?
114.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One moment, Dr. Welcher. When you were showing us this video, you walked to the side of the passenger side of the car, didn't you?
I did.
And why did you do that?
I was discussing with them what to do.
You were discussing with who what to do?
The driver.
In no way were you trying to imitate or give a demonstration of what you believed Mr. O'Keefe's movements to be?
Oh, no. This speed's just 2 miles an hour. I was having a discussion with the driver about what we needed to do to conduct the test.
So when you walked up to the passenger side, it wasn't to replicate a study or a movement or give an opinion?
No, that walking had nothing to do with this case except for me instructing the driver what to do.
Thank you for that clarification.
Sorry about that.
No apology necessary. Could you go back to the beginning when you were explaining this so we can go through it?
So this is the dynamic test two. So again, this is the view from behind. Just to avoid the confusion, I will start it here.
What speed is the car traveling?
You can see it. About 2 miles an hour.
Okay.
Excuse me, Your Honor, that is the objection that we spoke about.
Okay. All right, so that's noted, Mr. Lysing.
So, similar to the other test, this is the post-contact image of the transfers onto my arm. Actually, the yellow paint, you can see from my hand is here. This is from the arm and forearm. Here's the paint transfer pattern.
And that's slide number,
I'm
Dr.
sorry,
Welch.
I'm terrible with that. That's slide okay. 116 now. Thank that was 115.
Thank you.
Slide 116. What I've done is I've taken these yellow lines to show the extension of the components on the rear of the exemplar Lexus. Then I've done this extension of those same components on the rear of Ms. Reed's Lexus and shown how the approximate location of the fractures in the taillight match up with the approximate location of the contact of the arm onto the taillight.
Dr. Welcher, do you have any indication of how Mr. O'Keefe's arm was bent, what angle it was bent at?
Not exactly, but for these to be taillight shard fragments, they would need to be in the area of the taillight, but it could be further up. We know from the police photographs that there was a damage to the rear body panel in the area I'm searching here. So it's possible his arm was a little higher up and the glass hit the rear of the Lexus and caused that damage.
In the bottom right.
Excuse me, Your Honor, objection and
speculation. I will strike that last part about the glass.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The purpose of the circle is for what, Dr. Welcher?
To show, in this case, primarily the location of the lacerations up on the arm, the upper part of the arm, and that they match up with the locations of at least the one remaining shard in the rear taillight of Ms. Reed's Lexus.
Looking at the picture of the Lexus, bottom right middle, are there any marks on the Lexus itself that you took note of?
Yes, it's on the next slide.
Thank you.
Actually, it's two slides. So there, again, this is the evidence marker. There was a horizontal scuff. We know Mr. O'Keefe had blue jean type pants on. There's a scuff in the area that would approximately correspond to hip level for Mr. O'Keefe.
And next slide, please.
Yes, ma'am, 118.
Thank you.
Did you describe what you saw on the bottom right-hand corner photo as well?
I believe, yes, I did. That's the scuff that lines up with the approximate height of Mr. O'Keefe's right hip. So then I included previous image that you've seen, slide 119, with the reconstructed photograph of the rear taillight showing where some of the fragments are. You can see where those fragments are relative to the curvature of the taillight. They'd be in the area somewhat centered within the region of the two yellow lines on slide 119.
Is there anything about the photograph in the top right-hand corner that's important? If so, could you zoom in and show us?
So again, it's showing that this is when it's, I believe, in the Sallyport at the police station, showing that scuff on the right rear body panel.
Did you see any similar scuffs in the middle back of the car?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Did you see anything notable as far as damage to the middle back of this Lexus?
The middle?
Yes.
Like back where the doors are?
But with the middle of the back of the car, did you see any similar damage to the middle?
There
the
were scuff marks that ran along the bumper.
Okay, continue, please.
So this is just showing his jacket he was wearing, that the puncture marks coincide to the marks on his arm. This is from the autopsy report. A couple things that notes a half centimeter abrasion on his right lateral knee. He's got a laceration on his right eyelid that corresponds to the height of that rear fin, rear wind wing on the back of the Lexus.
I'm going to object.
Sustain.
Thank you.
How tall was Mr. O'Keefe?
73 inches tall, 6 foot one.
And how high was that wing from the ground on the back of the Lexus?
It was about 5 feet 11 inches, maybe 5 feet 10 and a half.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you notice anything about Mr. O'Keefe's right knee?
I noticed there was a half centimeter abrasion on the right lateral knee.
Did you note how high from his foot that bruise was on his knee?
We don't know the exact length of his knee. The abrasion appears to be right here at knee level. If you go back and look at where my knee is, that would be at the proximate level of the bumper.
And could you focus in on the bumper to show it relative to the height of your knee?
Sure. Oops. So my knee is approximately right here. This is where the bumper is. So the side of Mr. O'Keefe's knee will be in this general area.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sir, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of engineering certainty about the lacerations on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm and forearm regarding its orientation relative to the broken taillight on the defendant's Lexus?
Yes. Your Honor, may I read my report, my opinion?
Okay.
The location and orientation of the laceration on John O'Keefe's right forearm and arm are consistent with the geometry and orientation of the right taillight of the Reed 2021 Lexus LX570.
After considering these three different subjects that we discussed, the text stream data, analyzing the touching between the defendant's Lexus and Mr. O'Keefe's car, and then your demonstrations regarding the injury to Mr. O'Keefe's right arm, did you consider further evidence in reaching any conclusions as an accident reconstructionist and a biomechanical engineer?
Yes, I did.
Could you turn us to slide 124, please?
So this is some of the location of the physical evidence. Red plastic, clear plastic. His point of rest was indicated to be 7 feet off the roadway. There was a sneaker that was found near the curb. There were various fragments of taillight found in the snow on the morning of the incident, as to the afternoon of the incident.
Could you zoom in on those photos so that we can see the dates?
The date?
Yes.
Oh, sure. So January 29th at 5:46 p.m. This one's at 5:52. One's at 5:59. This one down here is at 5:46. So there were various fragments of the taillight that were ultimately pieced back together and determined to be from Ms. Reed's right rear taillight. Additional evidence was found. This is taken on the, again, the afternoon of the accident, again, around 5:50 p.m.
Could you zoom in, please, for us?
Sure. So what you see here is what was later identified as Mr. O'Keefe's right shoe.
And this slide number, Dr. Welcher?
Yes, ma'am, 127.
Thank you. Could you show us the time and date, please?
January 29th at 5:50 p.m. So a series of photographs. Again, you can see on the right-hand photograph that this is the roadway, this is the curb. The grass will be up towards the top of the right image on slide 127. The shoe is found, you know, up against, in the roadway, up against the edge of the curb. Baseball hat, again, acquired a same baseball hat. Baseball hat was also found in the snow. You can see.
I want you, before you move ahead, the baseball hat, could you give us a close-up view and also the date and time?
So that's where it's buried in the snow. These were taken on February 3rd. I'm not sure what time it was. There was also red liquid identified, I believe they indicated to be blood, in the snow as well.
And could you get it?
So, I'm going to sustain that objection and strike the last part of it.
I understand.
So we don't need to come to sidebar, right?
Just describe the color of what you saw rather than what it was.
There was red coloration in the snow.
And could you give us that date if it's different than February 3rd?
I thought that was February 3rd as well.
Is there a date on the photograph to the left?
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.